Hi, I'm Chris McKendry. Welcome to Equal Play, 50 years of equal pay in tennis, presented by JP Morgan. I joined ESPN in 1996, co-anchoring shows like SportsCenter and covering major sporting events like Grand Slam tennis tournaments. But to this day, interviewing Billie Jean King for the first time was one of the greatest thrills of my career. Not only did I learn more about her story, but meeting her afforded me the opportunity to thank her. It's conversations like these with women who made history that have really stuck with me. So on this podcast, I'll be speaking directly to some of these legendary women who fought to make it all happen. On today's episode, we're talking to two world-class tennis players and two leaders fighting for fair treatment for their peers. First, it is my privilege to speak with a titan of the game, Rosie Casals. A legendary player known for tenacity on the court, Rosie not only won titles throughout her career, including multiple Wimbledon titles with Billie Jean King, but was also a force behind the scenes. As a member of the Original Nine, she fiercely advocated for women's rights and equal pay, laying the groundwork for the Women's Tennis Association that we know today. Then we'll speak with a player who's continuing Rosie's legacy, Sloane Stephens. Sloane catapulted into the global limelight with a victory at the 2017 U.S. Open. A current member of the WTA Players Council, she also has unwavering dedication to giving back. Along with her mother, accomplished collegiate swimmer Sybil Smith, Sloane has brought tennis lessons and educational opportunities to thousands of kids across the country each year since 2013. As we celebrate 50 years of equal pay at the U.S. Open, it's time to hear from these trailblazers. Let's get into it. You know, 1973, we celebrate as such a big year, the anniversary of Title IX and equal prize money at the U.S. Open, Battle of the Sexes, but that's not when the fight began. Take me back to 1970, when the age of 22, you decided to write an editorial in World Tennis Magazine. What was your message and what were your concerns?
Well, our concern and mine, of course, would be prize money, the fact that the women did not have what the men were getting. And we thought, well, open era, you know, prize money, we can finally put it out on the table and earn a living. And it wasn't so. We were playing with the men, and obviously they would get the bigger share of the pie and the scheduling and everything. So the women were not happy about that. And we decided with my little article there for World Tennis and really telling them that we women were not happy and deserved more than what we were getting, and that we really needed to unite and get together and do something about it.
How did the nine of you come together? Who decided I'm in or I'm out?
Well, that was really a difficult issue. It was a little bit easier with those that had been contract pros with the National Tennis League, and that was Frankie Durd, Ann Jones, myself, and Billie Jean. We'd sort of broken away from the old establishment and declared ourselves professional. So we knew that putting yourself at risk and making demands were not always going to be easy. And of course, many of the women players that belonged to the LTAs and played for their country and depended on them, it was hard to get them on board. But we took that whole summer talking about it, letting them know that it was so important to make a stand now, especially with Women's Lib happening. And as you said, Title IX, there was certainly things in the work for women and getting the exposure that we needed through Women's Lib.
You just said a few things that strike me. As women, you put yourselves out there. You made demands. You took risks. Things women weren't supposed to be doing.
Well, that is true. But we had good, strong leadership with Billie Jean and I think myself. And as I described the other two, Ann and Frankie, and Nancy Ritchie was very involved in trying to rally the women together and letting them know that the only way we were going to make an impression, obviously, was to be one voice. When we got to Forest Hills in 1970, everybody was meeting in that tiny little locker room trying to talk about what we should be doing Fortunately, as I said, we had the attention of the press, and that was very important because without the press, you would still be in the locker room. And I think Gloria Steinem and all the things that were going on for women, burning the bra, the focus was definitely on women at that point in time.
You mentioned you had the press attention. Billie Jean King always attracted the press. She was the star. You were the fighter. Did you ever feel overshadowed?
You know, I think the star and the fighter belong together, obviously. We did well on the court, and I think we did well off the court. Like a team, you back your partner up, and I think that the leadership that she displayed, and I believe that year she didn't play, she was recovering from her knee surgery, and so she was doing some commentary, and she was in the locker room as well, trying to get the women rallied up, and I think that all of us realized that we needed to do things for ourselves, and we needed to make statements, which we did. I mean, we were very strong about our discontent with the prize money and the fact that the men were getting it all, and especially with the U.S. Open, our championships as well, that we should have had something better than what we were getting. The fight was definitely on.
Did you have the sense in the moment that you were fighting for something bigger? You were part of a movement?
Yeah, Chris. I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that Women's Lib and all that was happening there, the fight, the march to Washington, women finally making a statement of their discontent and not being equal. And of course, tennis, a great spotlight that we had a great platform, that it was really the time to do something. And I think you get those moments that are fleeting, but very important. And I know certainly Billie Jean has been one to be able to capitalize on those moments. So I think it came at the right moment.
Were you scared? Did you have moments of fear?
Well, I wouldn't say we were scared, or I was scared in that sense, because I think all my life I felt that I've been battling, whether it was, you know, coming up on the court, off the court. As women, you sort of have that little edge of having to fight for things. And there were very simple things. You wanted better locker rooms. You wanted better scheduling. You wanted better things to let people know that you are around, that you are important, that you are relevant to tennis. And the scary part probably was really taking that first bold move of saying, we're going to boycott Jack Kramer's tournament because he's giving so much 10-to-1 ratio to the men. What are we going to do? Are we going to take that? And you probably would have said the same thing and talked a little bit about boycotting the U.S. Open. But because it was the U.S. Open, we felt this was a good platform. Let's not do something that's going to be a negative impact. But I think history is a funny thing. If it's the right timing, and I think the right timing was for women at that point in time.
And the right women were in the role. How did your childhood, maybe the socioeconomics of the day that were made very apparent to you through the sport of tennis, what role did your childhood play in what you would decide to do as a young adult?
I sort of meandered into an elitist sport, not knowing so much about it, but loving it so much and playing through my junior years and obviously doing well and realizing that perhaps I could go somewhere, even though they did not have professional tennis at that time. You were an amateur. We knew that we could play Forest Hills. That was something in your dreams. And then way back somewhere, I heard about Wimbledon. And that was way across the pond that it was hard to imagine getting on a plane and flying all the way over there.
But you would. And in fact, you'd play with Billie Jean, winning the Wimbledon doubles titles 5 times. You have 112 doubles titles to your name. Perennial top 5 player. You went far, Rosie.
Well, I did. I'm very fortunate, you know, because it always takes people to help you. And I was very fortunate to have a very nice group of people at Golden Gate Park that raised the money for me because I didn't have the money to go back east and play all the junior national tournaments there were. And so eventually being able to go to England to play Wimbledon, and on top of it to have somebody, a partner like Billie Jean, that was kind of the icing on the cake. So was I scared? No. I was surprised she asked me, and I know I've been asked, well, did you feel the pressure? I mean, I was a pretty cocky kid, so I thought I was a pretty good tennis player. Of course, I had a lot to learn, and I needed more experience, but I think that's the only thing that helped me to be able to play with her is because I was so damn cocky.
You were cocky, you were gritty, you're smaller in stature than many of the professionals, a natural-born showman. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, I think it's like anything. When you have things that are perhaps against you, I mean, physically, in some ways, I was challenged because I wasn't Margaret Court with the long arms and being tall. I always say that I wish I would have been a couple of inches taller, that it would have been a lot easier to serve and volley and not have to run all over the place and jump as high to hit the overheads. But nonetheless, I think it did make me who I am, who I was then as a tennis player. And, you know, always feeling that I can get to every ball and hit every shot and win. You have one thing on one side and another thing, and you try and make up and you do the best you can.
Let's talk about those years. By 1973, network television put a woman's match, your match, from Hilton Head Island. You won. You also won the first match in Houston when you formed the Virginia Slims Tour.
Memorable.
That is a great footnote.
I may not have won Wimbledon singles or the U.S. Open singles or Australian, but I'll tell you what, it was just like a grand slam because it was so important. I think it's always nice to say you were the first one. And I was the first one to win a Virginia Slims, and it was a perfect opening to the Virginia Slims tour.
It sure was. And when we talk about the Hilton Head, I mean, NBC Sports came in and said, we're putting a woman's match on national television, not accompanied with a man's match, a woman's match. Popularity, it was starting to take off with the women's game, and that is when Chrissy came along and established herself a star. Were you surprised how quickly the women's tour gained momentum?
Yeah, I think to some extent, because we were so busy promoting every single moment of the Virginia Slims. When we were not playing, we were doing advanced media, we were doing primed clinics, everything to do with helping the promoter sell tickets, because that was really the bottom line. And yes, we had grown. Billie Jean had made her $100,000 in 1971, and no one thought that was possible. And so by 1973, as popularity with the Virginia Slims, more prize money, and then the youngster Chris Everett is beating all the older players. I remember she was playing Marianne Isel on the stadium court, and everybody's whispering in the locker room, you got to go see this kid. She's really good. And of course, all the old gals go on over there to see what's happening. And we thought for sure, because Marianne had her and should have beaten her. But imagine what Chris started when she beat her. And then Frankie Durr. And then she had to play Billie Jean. And of course, that's always a different story. So, I mean, we're in the locker room, and of course, you know, I'm wanting to hate Chris, and half the, you know, older players are, what are we going to do with her? She's going to be a pain in our side. And the old lady's saying, you know what? She's good for women's tennis. She is going to bring in the crowd. Everybody loves her. We need, you know, young blood. We're all, you know, in our mid-20s, and she's going to do it for the women. And so, you know, she was right.
She said, Billie Jean threw a lot of junk at me in that first match I ever played her, and it was a great strategy.
She definitely had her strategy, and she said, I can't hit clean balls to her because she strikes the ball so well, and her ground strokes are so deadly. So we really do need to give her a couple of drop shots, a couple of slices, and approach the net. So it seemed like the game plan was the right one because she ended up winning. And nonetheless, Chris got her opportunities to take care of all of us on every kind of surface and started, you know, the iconic two-handed backhand, because we had never really seen it that way. I mean, Peaches Barkowitz, one of the original nine, did have a deadly two-handed backhand, but I think Chrissy Pooh took it to a different level, so it became her signature shot for sure.
I would say that Chrissy Pooh has done okay for herself, that's for sure.
Oh, and she did okay for women's tennis.
How much fun did you have together, all of you traveling, breaking new ground? You weren't surrounded by these massive teams that the players have nowadays, and you traveled like a family.
You're right. We were a family. We loved one another. We practiced with one another. We ate with one another, competed, talked to one another, and, you know, helped. We helped one another. We didn't have the coaches and the money that today's players do. So we had to, out of necessity, we had to room together. We had to really talk about our sport. And we loved to do that. We loved to talk about tennis and even the matches and even our what was going on in our lives. We were a sorority of sorts that, you know, for the older players that had come from having nothing to creating something, and the youngsters coming in like Chris and eventually Yvonne and all the younger Jaeger and many Rinaldi, many of the younger kids. We really had to school them. We really had to talk to them about where the game had started, where it needs to go, and how important it was for them to participate, not only on the court, but all the other things to promote women's tennis. And Martina, Chris, and that group of players really got it. And I think they were very, I know they were very helpful in pushing women's forward the way it has continued to grow. But I would say that they were very responsible.
And players' lives have been enriched by everybody's experiences over the different decades and what Martina was able to bring to the table and live her life openly. Players live openly now. But Rosie, what impact would it have had on the tour looking back in the 1970s if it were to be out there that certain players were gay and in different relationships? Were you afraid to share this information at the time?
Yeah, I think it was very detrimental to the tour to be gay and to live that lifestyle, because the biggest question from the media was, when are you getting married? Are you going to have kids? And if you got married, like Margaret Court, she had kids and she swore that she would not go on tour with kids because they didn't belong on tour and prize money wasn't important. So there were a lot of issues, and certainly being gay was one of them, because in the 60s, 70s, and not until probably the 90s and certainly today's generation, because we come from the older generation where you couldn't even tell your parents that you were gay and you had this lifestyle, and you knew that they would figure it out, but they didn't want to talk about it. And now you can talk about it freely, and Billie Jean's been one of them, and certainly Martina has. And we always felt accepted on the tour. Our friends that we made many of on the tour knew our lifestyle, and certainly the players. I mean, we were protective about anybody's private lifestyle. We all cared about one another and our lives and how important it was to be able to protect certain things, but also it was a fine line that you want to promote the sport, women's tennis, obviously. So, yeah, it was a touchy subject.
It's time for My Two Cents, a segment sponsored by J.P. Morgan. At the end of every show, Rosie, I take a moment to ask my guests to reflect and offer some words of wisdom. So, Rosie, what would you recommend to women who are just joining the professional circuit or the WTA?
Okay, number one. Please know your history and where you came from. I know Billie Jean always says that, and I agree that you have to know your roots, okay? And I think to understand where tennis started, women's tennis, and how it started, and in a way, a legacy that you carry and should carry, that's one thing. And number two, that you have to love what you do and embrace it, because the tour now is very demanding. You have to really pay attention to not overdoing, overplaying, over anything. Like in anything, balance is a good thing. But you got to grow up. You got to take responsibility because that's important. You can't just put it on the coach and the people that surround you. It's not about them. It's about you. And I see too much about them. It's not about them. They're not the reason you hit the forehand in the bottom of the net or you're losing. If you want to be good, you know that it's a huge, huge undertaking. Not everybody's going to be number one, but you know what? You can do very well, especially with all the prize money that's available. And always follow your dreams.
Is there anything you would have done differently?
Pretty much nothing. I've loved my life. I still do. And it's been great. And I look forward to the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open giving prize money to the USTA. Hooray. And I know we're celebrating the Battle of Sexes. We're celebrating WTA's 50th anniversary. And I am very proud of all that has come in the past and before me, and hopefully will continue.
Before I let you go, I want to personally thank you. 20 years ago, I met Billie Jean for the first time. I had the opportunity to interview her with ESPN to do a profile on her. I had no idea I would end up circling back and hosting Grand Slam tennis. I didn't know if I'd ever get the opportunity to meet and talk with Billie. But as a kid who also grew up on the public parks and played National Junior Tennis League and then got to play college tennis, I just felt like I needed to thank her for everything. And I feel very much the same for you. So thank you so much. I mean, in 1970 through 73, it looks maybe to the outsider that you were fighting for equal prize money for the elite athletes, but you really weren't. You were fighting for all of us. And I just want to say thank you.
Well, that's the nicest thing I've heard because I have seen you many, many times. And certainly when we're at Billie Jean's penthouse apartment, I pretend that we're doing a podcast with all the things that we say. I don't think you can even print that. But I've always wanted to meet you. And I know we have met several times, but to do something like this, and I see you sitting there with everybody on your studio set, and I keep saying, I'm going to run in there and just make a splash. I'm going to run right through there and just disrupt things because I want to be there. I don't know why, Chris, just because I had never met you in this way, but I know you're a great interviewer. You do such a super, super job, really. You are an excellent professional, and we need more women like you, seriously. So I give that back to you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rosie. And I really meant it. I said to Billie when I met her, I'm like, everything you thought might happen with Title IX, I'm telling you, it happened, you know, and a baby of Title IX, and it's working. And you're right. Now it's time for all of us to keep playing it and paying it forward.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rosie. You take care. And if I see you at the U.S. Open, please just come charging through the set.
I will. I will. I promise you.
Tell them you've been invited. You've been invited.
Thank you.
I couldn't think of someone that epitomizes everything Rosie and the Original Nine were fighting for more than Sloane Stephens. In addition to the work she puts in on the court and her philanthropic work, since 2019, Sloane has served on the Women's Tennis Association Players Council. In our conversation, we talk about the responsibility of being an advocate and the importance of paying it forward. You know, to hear someone from the Original Nine, like Rosie Casals, talk about, you know, how they were fighting for the crumbs, as she put it. What does it mean to you to know that you're not fighting for the crumbs, that you're equal?
Yeah, I think obviously Rosie and Billie and the Original Nine, like I think for them, what they started and how far we've come is incredible and amazing. And we're still fighting to this day for more prize money. But I think to be equal and to know that all of the prize money is equal is incredible. It's incredible for our sport in general. Obviously, I think that women's tennis is the best sport in the world. And I think it's the most entertaining and exciting. But to be equal to the men and not have to be across from the locker rooms from them and knowing that we're making less, like, I think that's very comforting. Obviously it's been a long road for the fight for equal prize money, but I think where we are now is good, and we'll continue to fight. And obviously Billy and Rosie, like, they're still fighting for us till this day. Like, literally, they're still at tournaments, they're still showing up, they're still in press conferences and ensuring that we will have the best of whatever there is out there.
That's a great point. And I find it a fascinating point for women's sports and women, even myself covering sports, is the founding fathers, so to speak, the founding mothers, the women who first joined, be it media, press, competitions, or formed the WTA like Billy, they're still here to share their stories. How valuable is that?
It's incredible. Over the summer at Wimbledon, I attended where they had the original press conference, where they locked everyone in the room and made them sign on to the tour. And I spoke at that this summer, and I was like, wow, like, just listening to them, listening to their answers, listening to what they went through to make the tour happen is truly incredible. And obviously now, 50 years later, even from the tour being started, it's just incredible to see what they were fighting for, the vision back then, right? And I think now they can actually see it in real time, in real life. And I think that's incredible. And to be able to have leaders like Billy and Rosie and the rest of the original nine, like, they're still, you know, very much involved. They still very much want what we want. The vision is still aligned. They're still pushing for more. And I think I said I was going to stop doing player council because we do a lot of work and it was really stressful for me. And when I was there at the 50th anniversary, they're like, you can't stop, you can't get off. And I was like, now I feel like I have to stay. I was like, oh no. I was like, you guys work so hard. And to be able to continue that legacy and be able to help wherever I can, help my fellow players and just continue what they started is really special. And it's really important, I feel. And the work that we do on player council is important. And it's just something to continue.
Tell me more about that player council, because leadership amongst the ranks is so important. What is your vision and what are you working on right now?
Yes, what aren't we working on? I think with the new structure, circuit structure coming in next year, and just a lot of the things we have going on amongst our players, like, we have one of the best sports medicine departments in the world, and we're able to be unique and creative and still creating more things. And amongst the tour, we have a lot of stuff that happens. Like, every week there's like a different ball and a different surface and logistics around tournaments and travel and all of those things. Like, we're always trying to make it better for the players and easier and more convenient, so that when players get to the tournament, all they have to do is perform, not worry about scheduling and worry about the supervisor this week and what time their match. Like, there's just so many things that come with being a professional tennis player. And if myself and my fellow council members can make it easier for the girls on tour and make their experience a little bit better, I feel like we've done our jobs. And I wish that somebody before me was doing that, but I feel like our player council is pretty aligned on what the goals are, what the mission is, and what we stand for. So that's been really nice. And obviously I love all my council members, so we have a good time. And it's hard work, but it's worth it. I think at the end of the day, what we're leaving behind, the legacy that we'll leave behind, what we've changed and improved for players alongside Billy and Rosie and Venus and all of these people who've done amazing work behind the scenes, yeah, we'll be right along with them, which is really important, I feel.
Yeah, it's so true, the work you're doing on the council. And you know this, you're married to a professional athlete, but other leagues, that's something the league takes care of. Mm-hmm. That's something a union yeah. takes care of. And the players are all independent contractors. And I think sometimes the general sports fan loses sight of that. And there's a lot of things on your plate as an individual that in other professional sports, someone else is taking care of.
Absolutely. I think we would love to unionize. We would love to have a union that takes care of everything. I think we have our player council. We have our player council representatives who do a great job and they're amazing. But sometimes a lot of these issues are above us. And it's unfortunate because we don't have a group of lawyers who are a part of our union who are standing up for us and doing these things. Like, it's very in-house. And I think as the new circuit structure comes in and CVC comes in, I think a lot of that will change, but it takes time. And yeah, I think I would love to have a union and unionize. I think it would take a lot of work and pressure off of a lot of the people working on our tour, but I just don't think it's possible. But I think that eventually we will get to a place that it makes more sense for the players and the group of players. And we kind of just go from there.
It sounds like quite an education you've received being on the council and knowing all the ins and outs and even the idea of talking about a union. And I don't want to get off track, but that's a fascinating road to go down as well. And you see it happening.
Yes, definitely. I feel like Steve is our CEO. And I was like, man, I feel like I can run this place when you leave because I know.
Careful what you wish for, Sloan.
Oh, no. I'm like, he's so stressed out. Our poor CEO, like, we love him. He is the best. And I'm just like, oh, man, like, when you're gone, I feel like any one of us could run the WTA because we are so involved. And I feel like we are staff members.
Tell me about the Sloan Stephens Foundation. You are paying it forward and you are exposing more kids to sport, whether they become as competitive and as successful as you, or maybe it's just something that keeps them busy day in and day out.
So we're primarily based in Compton, California. We do the Compton Unified School District, and we serve about 10,000 kids a year. We do recess tennis, we do after school tennis, we do Saturday tennis, and we also have a high performance program that we run. And then across the country, we do diversity camps and youth camps for kids who obviously looked like me and didn't have the proper resources to get out there, and giving kids the opportunity to play and enjoy their first experience, because that really determines whether they come back or not, right? So it's like giving them the opportunity, making sure they love it, making sure that they enjoy it and they want to come back. That is my number one goal. And then I would say my second goal, obviously my mom being an educator, she's a school psychologist, is making sure that they're in school, that they're staying in school. Our biggest program is our summer reading program, which kids drop two reading levels over the summer. So making sure that they stay up to date. We have reading book club. We also do the Arthur Ashe essay contest every summer, and our kids win every year. So we're super happy about that because it gives the kids a chance to, you know, work hard all summer long, all through summer camp, and then have something at the end to look forward to. And they write their essays, they edit them, they do the whole thing. But education is our second part to that. So we're Tennis and Education Foundation, and we mix education in there pretty much everywhere we are. And also throughout the year, being able to, you know, keep up with their studies and making sure that they're doing well in school. We have SAT prep, ACT prep.
Oh, that's huge.
Everything. Yeah, so we do a little bit of everything. Obviously, my mom being a school psychologist is super helpful because we work in the school district. So we know the ins and outs of everything, really. And it's been a really big part of the foundation and being able to make sure that our kids keep up with their studies and their school. And we have a lot of first generation high school graduates and first generation college students. So that's been really big for us. Last year, we had our first kid go to college. When you graduate from a Compton Unified School District school, you get 2 free years of college at Dominguez High School. So our big goal is to have our kids graduate and go to Dominguez and hopefully, you know, other schools if they choose to, but having some of our kids be the first in their families to go to college and graduate high school has been really special for us and important. And I think that is our goal, you know, introduce tennis to people who would never pick up a racket because tennis is a very hard entry-level sport. It's expensive and it's not something that you would choose first. You would choose soccer or basketball or something a lot easier, right? So I think being able to introduce it to people who can use it as a life tool and use that as a vehicle, because then hopefully they introduce it to their kids and so on and so forth. So that is the goal of the foundation.
That is fantastic. Congratulations to you. I had no idea you were taking kids all the way up and in through college. And it's, I mean, having gone through it now twice in the last few years, the college prep, it's daunting, you know, and I can see if you don't have the right structure around you, how a kid would just say, oh, it's not for me. And it's so unfair and it's so stacked against so many kids. So kudos to you. Before I let you go, we do have 2 questions for you. It's time for my 2 cents presented by JP Morgan. I ask our guests, all of them Sloan, for words of wisdom before you go. First, what advice would you give a young woman who's thinking about joining the professional circuit?
Ooh, I would tell her, Well, first, keep going, right? You, no matter how tough the road is, you have to keep going, and there will be a lots of bumps. There will be adversity. There will be definitely trying times, but if your vision is clear and your goal is clear and your mind is clear, you will be able to achieve anything that you put your mind to.
And is there anything, if you look back over your career, anything you would have done differently?
Not a thing.
Ooh, that's a nice way to live.
Yeah, you live with no regrets and you do your absolute best and whatever happens, happens. And I feel like in my career, I could have never dreamed of anything that I've actually accomplished. I mean, winning a slam, finals of my favorite slam, winning a Billie Jean King Cup with people that I grew up playing tennis with from the time I was 10 years old, to, yeah, just getting a career high ranking at number 3 in the world. Like a young girl from Fresno, California, I could have never dreamed it up even bigger than this. So I feel like I've been blessed and I've had so many incredible things happen to me and I've just been lucky. And I feel like I wouldn't change a thing.
That's awesome, Sloan. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
We really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you in New York.
See you there.
Thank you so much to Rosie Casals and Sloan Stevens for joining us. Next episode, we're joined by another legend in the sport, Chris Evert. We'll talk about her trailblazing career and how she's watched tennis evolve. Equal Play, 50 Years of Equal Pay in Tennis, is presented by JP Morgan. It's a production of Neon Hum Media and the United States Tennis Association, and it's hosted by me, Chris McKendry. The series producers are Mia Warren and Rob Dozier. Executive producers, Shara Morris and Matt Guerra. Production management help from Samantha Allison and Taylor Sniffen. Our theme song was composed by Asha Ivanovich. Sam Baer is our engineer. Special thanks to Tara Bell and Rashina Warren.